Hi, I'm Josephine Ensign, author of Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, and Way Home, Journeys Through Homelessness. For the past 40 years, I've worked as a nurse practitioner providing primary care to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. I have the lived experience of homelessness as a young adult. I live and work in Seattle, a city with our nation's third highest number of people experiencing homelessness. Only New York City and Los Angeles have higher numbers. The Skid Road podcast aims to amplify a diversity of voices about homelessness in the Seattle area. Beginning in 2015, when a state of emergency was declared for homelessness in our city and county, I've done a series of oral history interviews with local people living and working at the intersection of health and homelessness. Public health nurses, emergency department physicians, politicians, heads of nonprofit agencies, activists, and frontline staff. People who have not only endured homelessness, but who are now housed and are working on creative solutions to homelessness. I've learned a lot from my conversations with all of these people, and I want to share their insights with you. On a semi-weekly basis, I'll post a new podcast episode featuring these conversations, interspersed with some of my own reflections. Learn more about this project through my website at josephineensign.com. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with others. Thanks for listening. Okay. So I'm Josephine Ensign, and here today with Mark H., and it's Wednesday the 22nd of March 2017, and we're here in the Jack Straw Studios. And Mark, as you and I were talking before this is for the Skid Road Project, which is really trying to kind of tease out some of the complexities of charity healthcare or safety net healthcare in King County. So the first question I have for you is, what led you to the work that you do? And as part of that, obviously, talk a little bit about the work that you're doing now.
How far back do you want me to go? I could talk about, like, military
and
all the way up to this.
Yeah, like, what led you to it?
I guess the first thing that really signaled it for me that this is the kind of work that I wanted to do, that I wanted to work with disenfranchised and, you know, people that didn't have a lot of resources available to them, was when in the first Gulf War. And this really is the defining moment, I have to say. It was in the first Gulf War, and I ran a minimal care ward just south of Iraq. It was right across the Kuwaiti border. And there was a lot of propaganda that had gone on, and the Iraqi army had told the frontline troops, which was mostly Kurds and, you know, really poor people, that we would kill them and eat them and all kinds of stuff. But we were unfortunate enough to have a whole platoon surrender to us, and they wound up on my ward. Fortunate enough to have a whole platoon surrender to us, and they wound up on my ward, and most of them were just starving. You know, they wouldn't eat. And the nurse I was working with suggested that we walk around and we take a bite of each one of their food. And we did. And then they started eating. And I guess I've been kind of chasing that kind of feeling since. I mean, it was a really amazing feeling. And I once I got out of the military, I was really proud of the fact that it was Kurds and Iraqi soldiers. I mean, because we had all the resources in the world, you know. So the people that were involved in that conflict, I like to believe that I was able to impact. And like I said, I've been chasing that feeling ever since. I left the military after being deferred from PA school three times, once to go to Rwanda, once to go to Bosnia, and the last time – I mean, once to go to Rwanda, once to go to the first Gulf War, and the last time was Bosnia. So I got out of the military while I was in Eastern Europe and lived in Hungary for a while. hit 30 and was like, okay, I'm going to go back now and I'm going to go to PA school since the military passed me over.
And you had been a nurse.
I'd been a nurse and I'd been accepted to PA school, but they was like, oh, sorry.
Right.
Well, you got to go here. We promise you'll go when you get back. Oh, sorry. You got to go here. So I finally had enough and I got out and then bummed around Eastern Europe for a while and then moved back to Seattle. I'd never been here before and applied at the University of Washington PA school and I got in. And at the time, I had started working as a nurse at the VA hospital and they had the Grow Your Own scholarship. So I owed them 6 years after I went back. And so I went back and I started working at the VA hospital. And, you know, that was really nice, too, because, you know, there's much crossover between the homeless community and the veteran community. But my politics, you know, I was aware of certain bills that were being passed. That was to decrease the budget for the VA hospital each year by a certain percentage after George Bush was out of office. And I was seeing Vietnam vets with really, really poorly treated or untreated post-traumatic stress disorder who couldn't hold jobs or relationships and all that kind of stuff walk out of my office as I was seeing, you know, 20 and 21-year-old Iraqi vets walk in with poorly treated PTSD. And I just – it just got to be enough. So I went to Harborview, moved to Harborview directly because I figured I could still see some of my homeless patients if I was working at Harborview. And I was. I saw a lot of my patients. And at Harborview, I worked at the Pioneer Square Clinic, which is in the heart of Pioneer Square. It's right in between – well, it's right next door to Union Gospel Mission. The Bread of Life Mission is around the street, around the corner, and Salvation Army is just like maybe 3 or 4 blocks down the street. So it was primarily the homeless community. And that was really my first dive into that community. And one thing about that was that I was really happy to be working with so many African American men, so many disenfranchised African American men. That was aces, and it was really self-validating because a lot of my patients would intimate to me that the reason why they were coming back is because they hadn't seen a black provider in a long time or ever. And, you know, I'm from South Central Los Angeles in Watts, and I know how to code switch. I know when I'm supposed to speak this way and when I can speak this way. So, and that's been essential to me being able to form connections with, you know, certain parts of the homeless community, especially African-American men. And, yeah, I worked at Harborview for a good little while, I think almost 7, 8 years. And while I was doing that, I saw an ad for the 45th Homeless Youth Clinic, which is where I first met you. That was a whole nother level. You know, I had this – at that time – you know, there was seeing people at the Pioneer Square Clinic, it felt like good work and I loved what I was doing, but so many patients were entrenched in that homeless life, you know, they were just entrenched, you know, I do this, this is my routine. I mean, I had patients that had not been outside of more than a 2-block radius from the Union Gospel Mission for as many as 10 years.
Wow.
But then you go out to the Homeless Youth Clinic and you catch these people, these kids, at an age where, you know, maybe you don't do anything. Maybe you don't make any kind of impression at all, but they're not so entrenched. I mean, I remember one patient who was, I mean, he was living out of a dumpster. And he had aspirations to be a politician, you know, and you're only going to get that, I think, there. You know, you're not going to get that at Pioneer Square. It's like, you know, where's my next bit of survival coming from?
Or we think that they were deluded.
Yeah. Or we think they were deluded. Right. We're like, oh, yeah, we need to turn up the whatever. But, yeah, the kids. And that was something else. I mean, it's all – this whole journey has been this, like, all these doors opening, but not in terms of, like, professionalism or advancing my career and those type of things. Just, like – empathy, compassion, and, you know, just humanity. Like, if you would have asked me ever if I would see transgendered clients or if I would take care of transgendered clients, you know, coming from South Central Los Angeles, being an African-American male and the military, there's just no way I would have ever thought that I was comfortable with it. And then I landed the 45th Homeless Youth Clinic, and just the resilience and the, you know, the, it dispels any kind of like BS notions you have about somebody making a choice about this. And thusly, if it's not a choice, how can you treat them poorly if it's not a choice? I mean, there's so much more to it. Just, they're just, people are just humans. They're just people. But even still, you know, it's like, how can you, I mean, the stories that some of these kids tell, I mean, at the hands of people that they look to for love, you know, that was very impactful. And so I'm still doing that medicine. I'm still doing that. I think that's probably right now 20% of my clients are transgendered men and women, which is, you know, when I'm sitting around playing basketball with my friends, you know, they're right. Like, dude. So, but
but now it's at Pike Place, right?
Yeah, so, Pike and Lake City. Quite a few patients that I used to see at the youth clinic they'll come out to 40. They'll more apt to come out to Lake City to see me than downtown Seattle for right. obvious reasons. You know, right. It's like it's just more predatory down there.
Yeah.
And so now, after that, after I had been working at the 45th Homeless Youth Clinic for a while, the machinations of Harborview and the whole like big thing, it got to be a little bit too much for me. And I like the community-based health idea. I had had this foot in the water experience of working at the youth clinic, and I certainly liked most of the people I worked with. And I think that there was a, if I can use this word, there was a certain amount of altruism that I really liked. So I transferred. I quit Harborview and I moved to Neighbor Care full time. And for a stint at Neighbor Care, I was medical director of homeless services, which included the HOT team, the REACH team, the Ballard Homeless Clinic, the 45th Homeless Youth Clinic, and the Boren Street Clinic, which was too much for anyone. It also was another revelation for me is that I do not have the skill set to be in a managerial position. I think I'm much too blunt and too candid. And if it's, you know, there's so much. I was amazed by the fact that people actually argued over how to deliver care to people who need care. And sometimes that arguing would slow down, you know, this process or make it really inconvenient for the people that it's supposed to serve. So I couldn't do that for very long. So I quit, and as I was quitting, my boss said, I can see the stress leaving your shoulders. And now I'm at the Pike Market Clinic, seeing some of the same patients that I was seeing all the way back at the Pioneer Square Clinic, which is awesome. And I'm also seeing patients out at Lake City, which is a lot of immigrant medicine, which has taken on a whole new behavioral health and mental health tone since the recent elections. So,
right.
Yeah.
And a lot of fear, I would imagine.
And I thought that was media blowout. I thought it was just like, oh, people are just blah, blah, blah. They're just making a mountain out of a molehill. I mean, of course, it shocked me, the whole election, but not to the point of where I would ever have to seek medical care. So when people were coming to me, I'm like, oh, man, this is real. And I started to listen more, and yeah, it's real. It's very, very real. And some of my patients, I think, are even scared to come see us now because they don't know what's going to happen.
And they're afraid that they'll be tracked down.
They'll be tracked down, right. Or this will be a means of, like, tracking them down. Yeah. And, you know, because, you know, anytime you enter the healthcare system, there's a lot of questions and there's a lot of identifiers and a lot of locators that people want to know.
Right.
Yeah.
So is there, like, a specific story, like one of your favorite stories, obviously protecting patient identity or things like that, but anything that you'd want to share of kind of one that just has stuck with you?
Oh, there's
your work.
Oh my God, there's so many. I mean, and then when you're called on to, think about some, it's funny because for a little while I was writing this one paragraph or two paragraph, just Facebook posts, and they were called the God post. And what I was doing was writing about my patients, male or female, but I was substituting for their name. I was putting God in there, like today God was a da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And that's a catalog of all those stories, and now I can't remember any of them. No, just kind of just all of them. I mean, right now I have one patient who's been struggling with addiction and alcoholism, and their partner just passed away from the same things, and they're making a really strong, strong effort. And I guess maybe I'm a little callous now because you've seen it so many times where they're like, ah, that's it, I'm done. And you really see a patient throw themselves sincerely into trying to get past their addictions or at least manage them. And then, okay, so my favorite story will be if this patient stays, stays sober for a while. Right. I do have a funny story.
All right, let's okay. hear that.
When I was working at the VA hospital, and this one sticks with me. I was working at the VA hospital. I was floating down to the spinal cord injury unit.
And this is when you were working as a nurse.
This is when I was working as a nurse. And so the spinal cord injury unit was mostly paraplegics and quadriplegics and people that had varying degrees of spinal cord injury. And so my wing at the time, I was doing what I was doing. And they came up and said, patient in four whatever. His family's coming today, and he might be going home, so he needs help getting spruced up. So, you know, and, you know, sometimes I'm a little over-eager. So I walk in the room, and I'm like, hey, man, family's coming. Let's go. Let's get spruced up. He's like, no, I'm good. And, you know, I start helping him off with things, even though he's protesting. And then I open his shirt, and he's got, like, this swastika, right, and he's a quad. You know, he's kind of a quad. You know, he doesn't have real good movement. And he's got this swastika from, you know, from sternum down to umbilicus and across. And he's sitting there looking at me terrified. And I started laughing because I thought to myself, this must be this guy's biggest nightmare, this big black man. And he can't move. I mean, I finished helping him get, you know, set up and everything. And I wasn't mad. He was like overly apologetic and went into stories about his youth and all that. But I don't know. It was just an interesting time, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And that's one of them. I really can't recall.
So he was able to kind of address the awkwardness of it? And
yeah, he had to.
And he kind of apologized for this?
Yeah, he says I was really not very bright as a young man, and I did a lot of stupid things that I feel sorry for, and you know, it started to make me feel bad after a while. It's like, and by the end of it, you're thinking to yourself that he's stuck with that, you know? For the rest of his life, he's stuck with that symbol or whatever else. And then I also felt good that he did get a bed bath from a large black man.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I saw him again. I went down and saw him again. He was like, you know, thanks, you know? And shirt was covered up, so it wasn't even an elephant in the room. It was just...
Or a swastika in the room.
Yeah. We broached it and it was gone, you know.
Oh.
Yeah, I can't, yeah.
So, and you've spoken a bit about the frustrations that you felt as more of an administrator kind of a role. But
yeah.
Other kinds of frustrations that you've felt? And also, it sounds like, you know, running into racism stuff for your patients.
Yeah. Yeah. Not just racism. I just hate the stigma that goes with a lot of my patients. I mean, a lot of the stigma that they have to put up with. That's very frustrating. Like, it's easy for a patient to go to emergency room, and then you can almost see how sometimes it's really flippant, and sometimes it's, you know, they're really glanced over. You can see that sometimes in the discharge summaries, and yeah, and I understand it. I can honestly say I've worked in an ER and I actually understand it, but it's still frustrating. And sometimes I think some of the specialty services don't take my patients very seriously either. I mean, I can't cite specific incidents, but there's a lot of barriers. There's a lot of things up in front of people that don't have homes. You know, I could do the surgery, but he doesn't have a place to go, you know, and it's like, I don't know. That gets hard. And the frustrations of the medicine is slow. You know, sometimes it might be 2 months before you get the person even look in your general direction, you know. And that's hard because, you know, we come out goal-oriented, right? We all come out like, I got to get that A1C down and I got to blah, 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 blah. And the present healthcare system kind of almost demands that, right? These numbers. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't work for the, you know, the homeless community.
Just really in terms of building that relationship.
And, yeah. And yeah, you're not going to be able to do that.
What they're dealing with, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a agenda setting really leans much more towards the patient, I think, in when you're doing homeless medicine.
Right.
So that's a little frustrating. Like seeing numbers come down saying you've got 7 patients whose hemoglobin A1Cs are 14 and you're like, well.
That's actually good.
Yeah, you don't know, man. It was 400. No. Yeah, that's actually really good, especially when you're dealing with food banks and yeah. wherever you can eat and, oh, that little question of just survival in general. You know, so that's that gets to be a little bit frustrating. And the bureaucracy is really frustrating. You know, recently there was new, and I hate to be this specific, but it bugs me. There was a bunch of new satellite clinics that were set up in the downtown corridor, the downtown area, which is a place that's already saturated with homeless care and mm-hmm. facilities and resources for the homeless community. And then there's places like Georgetown and other places that could use it. And I watched maneuvering go to put it there. To put it downtown. And it was obvious to everybody that just didn't make any sense. And that was very frustrating to me. It's like, come on, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm a little naive, you know, grants and revenue and finances and everything. I mean, I come into this thing like, oh my God, we're going to build a clubhouse and build, you know what I mean? We're going to take care of people. And then you get to that middle management and it's still dollars and cents and it's still numbers, even. You know, even if you're wearing a peace sign.
Right. Right. Yeah. So was that through neighbor?
Yeah, that was through neighbor care.
Yeah.
I mean, I really loved what we were trying to do at neighbor care. I mean, when I was mm-hmm. medical director, we did a lot of really cool things. I think, you know, we got Narcan into the hands of all the hot nurses. You know, we implemented that 12-week latent TB treatment.
And maybe hot nurses to specify.
Oh. Yeah, homeless housing and outreach team.
Yes, the hot
nurses.
Right, right.
Yeah, wow.
So it won't be taken out of context.
Yeah, right. Who's that guy?
Yeah. So you got Narcan to them.
And yeah, and we finally got like set protocols, and you know, and I can't take responsibility, but we finally got set protocols for care of transgender clients mm-hmm. at Neighbor Care, which is really good.
Nice.
You know, so everybody's on the same. Pretty much the same page, and that was really good.
Right.
Yeah.
So some kind of standardized care and approaches.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. So what are your hopes for the future of safety net healthcare in King County, but also even nationally?
God, you know, that would have been an easier question to answer before this election. I can't get into the minutiae of it, but I hope there remains a way, whatever that looks like, for us to deliver compassionate care to people who are unhoused and don't make a lot of money. I mean, that's just the bottom line for me. That's the bottom line for me. And I think there's some really scary people that are playing with a lot of people's health and well-being. But I also feel like under President Obama, if I can say it this way, we got really complacent, I think. I think that even in healthcare, I think we got kind of complacent with things. And the most optimism I have about this is that it's kind of a rallying cry. You know what I mean? That this is actually people who are compassionate and care about other people and, you know, believe in equality in all the planes, or at least strive for it. To really do stuff now, you know.
We almost took it for granted, you think, before?
I think to a certain degree. I mean, yeah. And maybe that's with hindsight now that this guy is in office. You know, looking back, you could like, well, we should have did more. You know, that's, you know, whatever with the Republicans. They'll always be that. You know, Republicans and conservatives, I don't, you know, whatever with that. But I hope that this is kind of a rallying cry for people. And I also, you know, if I'm speaking globally, I also believe that a lot of aspects of what's going on in America right now have been there for a long time. the way we treat each other, the way we treat women in America, the way we treat people in, regardless, I mean, people because of their gender preferences, their sexual preferences, people of color, that these things have been around for a long time. And we've dressed it up really nicely to the point where we didn't really even discuss it. I mean, that's one of my biggest frustrations in Seattle is like really hard issues with progressives. You can end a progressive party if you bring up too many hard issues. And I think that we've dressed up this weed, and now this weed is huge. And now we have to address it. And that's the silver lining as far as I'm concerned, is that we all have to now pay attention to what's going on to our people, to people around us, regardless of what they look like, what they prefer, because it's affecting all of us now, you know? So for Seattle proper, you know, it's such an easy thing to say a solution to the homeless problem because you see the city changing. You see it getting more populated going up, and you see it spreading out and getting more populated by those people who aren't housed. And I never know what the solution to that is. I never know, but it's really disheartening. I don't know to look to the mayor or look to whoever, but that's what I hope happens. I hope that everybody that isn't in a home has access to quality, compassionate care, non-judgmental care. They get treated like a human being when they're seen. It's as simple as that.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I'm burned out on the politics, you know, right now. I really am. The solace is going to work and being a face that says, yeah, nah, that's really stupid. You're fine, you know, that's some other stuff. And our little area right here, this is safe, and we'll take care of whatever we can take care of, you know? All right.
Nice. So is there anything that I haven't asked you that you'd want to address and finish up with at all?
I was searching for religion at one point, and I belonged to this church for a while. I'm not doing that so much anymore, but I belonged to this church for a while, and there was this one portion of it where we had to go out in a week and do something different that we hadn't done before and then come back to church and tell everybody this class what we had done. And there were two people in the class, and one lady said she had been walking by this woman, this homeless woman, for 5 years and had never said hi, never said a word to her. And because of this class, she had stopped and said hi. And the class clapped. They were like, oh, that's great. That's taking a stretch. And I was like, I'm out. That was it. That was it for me. How can you walk by somebody for... Anyway, the one thing I want to leave is just, I think my patients often say that they feel invisible. And I don't know why that's ringing with me today. I wish more people would just say hi or say, no, I don't have money. Just look at them and say, no, I don't. Or, but don't ignore them.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it.
Nice.
Yeah.
So thank you. I want to thank you for taking time.
Well, thanks for giving me this opportunity, Josephine. Thank you.
All right.